With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
No. I am the Father.
Rosebud. What's in the box?
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you all to hell!
Hello and welcome to this late spoiler special podcast. Today we will be spoiling the new film from Bong Joon-ho, Parasite. I'm really excited to talk about this extremely twist-filled movie with Forrest Wickman, Slate's culture editor, who's here with me in Slate Studios in New York.
Hey, Dana.
Hi, Forrest. And talking to us from the East Bay is Slate culture writer Ingu Kang. Hi, Ingu.
Hello, hello.
All right, so guys, this is kind of a major task to spoil Parasite for a few reasons. For one thing, I just feel like this is a really important movie. I really, really loved this movie, and I feel like maybe the first movie of this year since Us, since Jordan Peele's Us, that has not only haunted me for a couple weeks after seeing it, but that I can't stop talking about with everyone who's seen it. The minute you ask someone if they've seen Parasite, you launch into a conversation about it, which often, like the conversations about Us did, you know, get into these interpretive details and different ways of looking at the facts that are on the screen. So if any movie ever needed to be spoiled this year besides Us, I think it's Parasite. And as per usual, I'm going to just go around and quickly get your responses, Forrest. I know you loved the movie, too. You're definitely a thumbs-upper.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think often with these spoiler specials, we try to get people who have differing opinions on a movie. So there's some people who are pro and some people who are con. But there seems to be just no one at this point who is con on this movie. And I kind of don't expect there will be a lot of people. It's really, really great and also quite likable and fun and thrilling. And like Us had its detractors, partly because it gets so far into a very sort of abstract and supernatural realm. And this movie manages to do so many of the same things, but in this really grounded, concrete way. And I keep going back and forth about whether I think Parasite is vastly better or whether they're just like these two doppelganger movies in my head that are equally great. And
yeah, doppelganger movies about doppelgangers.
Exactly.
It gets into a real mirror game. Ingu, what about you? Are you going to bring any shade to this love fest for Parasite?
I'm happy to bring shade for Us, but this movie is directed by Bong Joon-ho, and he is, I don't know, like he's been one of my favorite directors for the last 10 years, I think. Ever since I saw The Host and Mother, which are two Korean movies that he made. He's also made more recently Stateside, or with sort of Hollywood actors, Snowpiercer and Okja. And this movie for me is in so many ways like a return to form and just like a perfect distillation of so many of the things that like Bong is truly excellent at. And so, yeah, sorry, like, you've got total unanimity here, just like a love fest for this movie.
But even if we're not fighting each other about the movie's quality, I still feel like there's a lot of interesting roads to go down.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack. And I feel like we should also lay our credentials down. I think we're kind of all Bong super fans here. I mean, I know that Dana, you and I spoiled Snowpiercer back in the day, and I think you didn't like it quite as much. And I know Ingu, I think, doesn't like Snowpiercer quite as much. A lot of people don't like Snowpiercer quite as much, for example.
I mean, both Snowpiercer and Okja are completely original. I mean, they're fantastic in that sense, is that they are completely true to his vision,
right.
And his vision is like no one else's. But I would say that this movie, I agree with Ingu, is sort of the, to me, it's the culmination. It kind of brings together everything that was great about his earlier Korean movies with the scale, you know, the elaborate scale and just sort of gorgeous production of his whatever you call them, international productions. My favorite movie of his is probably this and The Host. But then there's also Memories of Murder, his early, maybe not his first, maybe. But
second movie.
which is also a fantastic kind of genre mashup the way that this one is. I mean, what this movie does with genre is so interesting, and we'll get into it as the conversation goes on. But, you know, usually when I'm writing about a movie, in the first paragraph or two, I sort of in some way define what genre it is. Is it a thriller? Is it a drama? Is it a comedy? Or is it some mixture of two different genres? But this movie and Bongs in general goes so far beyond that classification that they keep on changing what they are, right? I mean, this is really a Hitchcockian thriller that's also a social satire, that is also a really touching family drama, but it's extremely funny, and it's somehow operating on all those registers at once.
With, like, a weird element of, like, horror as well, which we'll get into. But, yeah, I think, like, the really amazing thing about the way that Bong works with genre play is that you never, like, see the seams. He can really, like, play with these, like, hairpins in tone, and they just sort of seem like the most natural thing in the world, as opposed to someone who was like striving really hard to like struggle putting together like horror and comedy, for example.
Yeah, he's very, very ambitious in that way and has a great deal of confidence. I think of him as his camera is its own kind of confident roving eye that knows what it wants you to look at, even though you might not always know why you're looking at that particular thing at that moment. But I feel like we're being too vague. We need to get into the specifics of this story. So it roughly can be divided into three acts, that each of which has a big twist at the end, right? So let's get into the first one. As we open the movie, we meet one of the two families that's going to be this doppelganger family, right? Two families of four that confront each other over the course of the movie. And the first family we meet is the Kims, who is this miserably poor family who live in a sub-basement in Seoul on a sort of rundown alleyway. And as we first meet them in this sub-basement, Ingo, you want to pick it up from there? What are they doing?
I love the way that this movie begins, because it starts with the four of them. So there's a mom and a dad, and then there's also an older brother and a younger sister. And essentially, the two siblings are, I think they're supposed to be older teenagers. And they are looking for a Wi-Fi signal that they can steal off of, like, whatever environment is sort of like around them. And there used to be like a cafe where they used to take all of their internet signal. And now like the cafe has like shut down or something. And so like they're just sort of like roaming around their house looking for a signal, because otherwise they don't have any phone service. You sort of like see their house like in this way. They're sort of like a giant window in the living room, which initially sounds nice, but it only looks onto the street. And one of the things I really like about Bong and his sense of humor is that it's like really quite earthy. Usually when they're looking outside this window, the family just like is sort of captivated by whether some drunkard on the street is going to like piss on their window, because that's sort of like where they are in society. And so basically we get sort of like a tour of the house, and then they sort of like end up at like a bathroom, and like only by sort of like leaning over the toilet in this like very specific way are they able to get any sort of signal.
The production design of their apartment, which was built specifically for the movie, as was the rich family's house that we'll get to later, is just so fantastic. And one thing that's great about it is that toilet, which is just this open elevated toilet that's like at the top. You don't even quite see how you would fit onto it, because it's just a few feet from the ceiling of this low basement that they're in. And that in itself, I mean, just the way every detail in this movie means something and has something to do with the thematic content. You know, obviously the idea that sort of the highest point in their apartment is this is this open toilet is a sort of testimony again to where they are in society.
Right. I mean, we should unpack sort of one of the obvious more thematic aspects of this scene of them getting the Wi-Fi, which is that there's a lot of imagery in the movie that at first at least suggests that, you know, they're parasites, right? And so in this case, they're literally leeching, you know, internet off of their neighbors. And then there's like a close-up of an insect in their apartment early on. And then they're constantly being, they're being fumigated, basically, right? Like the streets are being fumigated and it just comes into their apartment. So there's all these images that suggest that they're sort of insects preying on the neighborhood, which would be simplistic and maybe even sort of problematic if it weren't made much more complicated later on in the movie.
Oh, yeah, the title gets pretty multivalent. Oh, yeah. So the first plot point that matters to us is that the son finally gets a real job. The only work that we see the family doing early on is that they fold pizza boxes for this pizza delivery chain, which even that seems to be a job that they're always on the verge of losing because they can't fold them as fast and as efficiently as other workers.
Yeah, it's very like 2019, both in the sense that it's like, I feel like there's a lot of globalization in this movie. And so the fact that there are these people in Korea who are folding, you know, pizza boxes, and also it's like a total gig economy job where they can't get any like consistent salary or anything.
And there's a real indignity to that scene where they interact with the very young manager for the pizza place, right? He's essentially telling them, you can always be replaced. There are a million people in line behind you who can fold boxes better than you can. And that will come up later when they get jobs where at least apparently, you know, they're slightly higher on the social ladder and treated with a bit more respect. But the son of the Kim family, who's played wonderfully by a young actor named Choi Woo-sik, eventually gets a real job. So his friend, who's about to go studying abroad for a year, recommends the son for this job.
I think really interestingly, this friend who is in college because his family can't afford to send them to college, comes over with this like gigantic rock called a scholar stone. And basically, like, the stone is placed in a very fancy, like, wooden box and brings it over as a gift. And basically, the scholar stone is supposed to bring wealth onto the family, which is, like, both, like, very much a foreshadowing, but also, like, ironic, as we'll see. And so I think it's interesting also that this wealthy friend who does get to go to college is essentially in love with his tutee and tells Choi Woo-sik's character, like, I trust you not to have any sort of like romantic entanglement with like my student. And there's sort of this implication that like, because his friend, who he sort of like wants to have as like a placeholder for his job, is poor, isn't a viable sexual rival, which of course turns out to be a mistake.
Right. So when Choi Woo-sik's character arrives at this at the rich people's house, I feel like it's an important story beat when he does, because we're essentially transitioning to the second part of the movie in which the two families encounter each other. Forrest, do you want to describe the Park's house and just what it looks like?
I mean, basically, it's an extremely modern house. It's extremely spacious. It has its main feature are just huge windows, like huge floor-to-ceiling windows, which are used wonderfully throughout the movie. So I guess, you know, if you picture sort of like a Frank Lloyd Wright house, it's kind of like that.
And it's supposed to have been designed by this famous Korean architect who was also its first owner. And he, in a way, I mean, even though he never appears in the movie, there's a portrait of him on the wall.
Right.
And he kind of becomes this, to me, sort of like class patriarch looming over the movie, right? What's important to this family, the Parks, that lives in this house is not just money, but prestige, right? I mean, sort of education, social status, you know, mobility. And the architect seems to represent all of that because he's this internationally renowned artistic figure.
Right. And, you know, one of the ways in which everybody is constantly chasing prestige in this movie that really resonated with me as somebody who, you know, at one point after college, I taught English in Spain, and then I was going to teach English in Korea. And if you ever spend any time on the forums for like English teaching assistants in Korea, they always talk about how the fact that you're American, and especially, frankly, at least according to all these people on the forums, like if you're white and blonde and blue-eyed, like you will get paid more. And that's something that keeps coming back in this, where they like take on American names. And then, well, we should get into the chain of recommendations a little bit, as they call it. But one of them ends up faking being an American just to be more desirable.
Or at least having studied. Does she say she's American?
I think she says she grew up well, I mean, same difference maybe, but I think she lies and claims that she grew up in the United States, yeah.
But I did just want to point out that, yeah, the house, just like the underground apartment of the Kims, I mean, they're really, those are the two main sets of the movie, although there's a few things that happen out in the world, a couple of really important things that happen out in the world. But those two sets are really important in their geography and their kind of spatial orientation. That window that they look out on, you know, the equivalent of the Kims' very murky window looking out onto a guy pissing on their building, right? I mean, it's all just, there's almost a direct mirroring of every element of one apartment in the other.
Right.
For me, like, the first third of this movie plays out like a really delicious heist movie. It's just that, like, the thing that they're trying to gain or accrue is, like, social capital. I think, like, what is really, like, fun about this movie is that you see that the poor family has, like, studied wealth, essentially, enough to, like, know how to devise, like, their own class desirability for the rich family, in spite of, like, not really having any. And so when the poor son sort of, like, comes in and, like, knows exactly how to, like, feign a sort of authoritativeness mixed with, like, a bit of, like, artistic temperament in order to trick the wealthy mother, who he's been told is, like, a little gullible, a little, like, silly as a person. He basically knows, like, exactly how to play her. And so instead of sort of, like, doing, like, a straightforward lesson, because the wealthy mother wants to sit in on, like, the first lesson, he sort of, like, does this, like, very funny act almost, where he touches the student's pulse and sort of, like, diagnoses that, like, she responds to stress in, like, a certain way. And so it's not just this sort of, like, imparting of knowledge, but almost this idea that, like, he has these, like, other powers that he's, like, able to impart to her to give her an advantage. And then basically he finds out that the wealthy mother is convinced that her, I don't know, like, 8-year-old son is a Picasso in the making, because she shows him this, like, very, like, kid-like painting that, like, she has on her wall. And the poor son sees this and basically passes off his sister as a renowned painter and possible art therapist. And he's able to also, like, sell his sister off as a desirable addition to the household by saying, oh, well, she was educated in America and she doesn't really take just any old client off the street. Like, the little boy has to be, like, worth her time. And so there are these ways that, like, because the poor family knows exactly what the rich family wants out of, like, their help, because it's not just, like, labor that they're looking for. It's, like, a, like, labor plus that's sort of, like, combined with, like, prestige. I think a lot of the fun of this, like, first half of the movie is them figuring out how to scam this rich family in exactly the way that they want to be scammed.
Yeah, that especially comes into play when the sister of the Kims, the poor family, comes to work for the Parks, because it's revealed all of a sudden that she, of all the shysters of the family, is maybe the most skilled among them. In fact, I think it's her who upgrades from art tutor to art therapist, right? I think she goes in as an art tutor, and then when she sees all the scamming that's there for the taking, she is the one who says, oh, well, it looks like your son has gone through all this trauma. The mom seems convinced that her son is emotionally disturbed, although he just seems to be your average sort of hyperactive kid. And the sister uses that to worm her way in and say, oh, well, actually, if you're willing to pay an even more pretty penny, I can work as an art therapist as well.
And also your son needs to see me like 4 times a week.
Right. So she is the one who sort of ups the ante and also finds her way clear to getting her dad hired. And the way she does that is one of the funniest stretches of the early part, which I agree, Ingu, it has the fun of a heist movie. There's almost like an Ocean's 11 energy to that period of the movie when the family is starting to infiltrate. Remember how she gets her dad the job as the family's driver?
Right. Well, I should say it's been like 2 months since I've seen this movie, so I'm a little fuzzy on some of the stuff. But basically, she like drops her panties in the car, right?
And when getting a ride home from the driver, right?
Yeah. And then implies that he was a creep and came on to her, I think. Right?
The implication is that he was having sex with somebody else in like the family's like car where like the rich father gets like taken back, like to his job and back from it. And so essentially the wealthy family was really into this idea of having like a young hip driver. But once it's clear that like he is not as discreet as he should be, or so like the rich family is made to believe, then he's fired. And then the father of like the poor family is then installed as like the driver. And then the final piece of the puzzle is there's been sort of like a loyal servant that sort of like almost came with the mansion. It's this sort of middle-aged woman in like a gray uniform who knows exactly how a sort of like servant to very wealthy people is supposed to behave. And she had been the servant of the architect when he lived in the house. Now, like, the wealthy family employs her, and they essentially don't have any complaints about her, except for the fact that maybe she, like, eats a little too much of their food, which seemed, like, very hilarious to me, because, like, of course, this, like, very wealthy family would begrudge their live-in housekeeper, like, $3 a week or whatever. Through, like, a very elaborate scheme, convince the wealthy family that their housekeeper has tuberculosis. By triggering the housekeeper's, like, very rare, very extreme peach allergy. And so when they sort of pass off, like, a napkin filled with, like, a very, like, visceral-looking hot sauce for blood, then the housekeeper is sent away. And the mom of the poor family is installed. So, like, by the end of, like, that first third of the movie, they have every single one of, like, the poor family working for the rich family. And the rich family has no idea that they are all related. and also that they are slowly sort of have grown, like, entirely dependent on this family in order to provide for their own family.
I just have to jump in and say that the editing of that sequence, the montage with the peach fuzz and making her cough, and then, you know, at the very last moment, putting the hot sauce on the napkin is just fantastic. It's one of those moments when comedy and suspense come together just perfectly in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's a total master of that stuff, and he also is extremely good. I mean, we were talking a little bit about the way he bends genre, and he's extremely good at making genuinely really suspenseful sequences out of extremely silly heist concepts. So in this case, we have this, like, peach allergy and the fake hot sauce blood and so on. And then later, there's this whole Hitchcockian, like, ticking clock sequence, except for instead of there being, you know, a bomb that's about to go off, it's just that the housekeeper needs to make a particular noodle dish that the son loves in time in the 8 minutes before the son comes home. And it's like genuinely really suspenseful and hilarious that it's a noodle dish.
Yeah. Well, that moment, I would say, is kind of the pivot, that great, great scene or sequence, really, the long set of scenes where the rich family go out camping, the poor family essentially move into their house for the weekend and are just partying down in their living room. And then that turns into, wait, the rich family's coming back and they want this particular dish and they want it in 8 minutes. And, you know, meanwhile, the entire house is just covered in liquor and, you know, snacks, and everybody has to hide. That's another of those moments where there's an enormous amount of plot turns being packed into a very short period of time. And just the editing of that scene is really brilliant and very slapsticky in the end, right? I mean, all of the hiding under tables and having to crawl out at just the right moment. It's just one of those moments where slapstick comes into play in a beautiful way. Ingo, do you have any thoughts about that, I think, pivotal sequence of the Kims partying down at the Parks house?
I love that scene because, like, by this sort of, like, midway point of the movie, they've basically completed their heist, and you're sort of left wondering, like, well, what's left? And so the poor family, while the rich family has gone camping, and I have to say, like, the camping detail was perfect because it's all about, like, wealthy people who have decided to voluntarily spend tons of money to sort of act for a weekend, like they don't actually have any resources. While the rich family is out camping, the poor family are, like, basically, like, in their living room, like, eating all of the food, drinking all of the liquor, and sort of daydreaming to one another about what it might be like if the son actually did end up marrying, like, his student, and this gigantic mansion would become their own house. And of course, that's right when everything sort of, like, begins to fall apart for them.
Right. And it's also the moment that the movie does one of these hairpin tone shifts that we were talking about early in the podcast. For us, do you want to talk about the big twist in that scene?
Right. So the big twist in this movie is that it, you know, whereas Us had, like, one set of doppelgangers, this movie has a whole nother set of doppelgangers. So in addition to this rich family and the poor family who lives in the sub-basement apartment, there is also a whole nother family that lives underneath the Parks house in this bunker. And basically the way we learn that is that the housekeeper comes back. And then basically I mainly remember a long shot of a camera sort of plunging deeper and deeper into the house and writing like, holy shit, in big letters in my notes.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a moment when it's revealed that as low as the Kims are on the social ladder, there are people that are even beneath them. And that's the moment that you start to see, oh, this isn't the simple class satire that we thought it was about, you know, the rich versus the poor. It is actually about systemic poverty and, you know, the way that there's always somebody below you on the ladder. So, yeah, the old housekeeper shows up in the middle of their wild partying night and insists on getting in, seems very desperate to go and retrieve something. And that's when we discover, because she shoves this shelf aside in the kitchen, that there's an entire secret subterranean floor that neither we nor the Parks themselves, who own the house, seem to know about.
Yeah, I mean, and thematically, it's rich in the way that you suggested, Dana, and that I'm sure we're going to talk about more. And also, it's just, we should say, it's really well set up. Like, this movie is extremely tightly and intricately plotted. An example of this is, Ingu, you were talking earlier about how the Parks, the one thing they don't like about this housekeeper is that she supposedly eats too much. And then we basically eventually realize that she's just been sneaking food down to her husband, who lives in this bunker in the basement.
At one point, she does get accused of sneaking food down into this bunker. And she says, no, I pay for all of the food myself, and took a great deal of pride in it. The reason why this bunker exists in the first place is because she explains that the architect basically made this nuclear bunker in case there is an attack by North Korea, and so you have this extremely sturdy bunker where that is reserved for only the wealthiest of the wealthy to even get to afford in Seoul. At the very beginning of this podcast, we had mentioned that the poor family had been getting Wi-Fi from a cafe. And it turns out that that husband had been the owner of the cafe. And when the cafe folded, he was basically chased by loan sharks. And he knew that he would never be able to repay that money. And therefore, he has been hiding out in this bunker for the last 4 years.
Okay, that's great.
Wow, no, I did not put together that cafe
thing.
I
didn't get the cafe detail either, not at all the first time.
And I remember thinking that detail was so smart because it contrasts the casual cosmopolitanism of the rich family versus this other kind of middle class striving level of cosmopolitanism that they try to reach and can't quite grasp, which is of course represented by the failure of that Taiwanese cafe.
Right. So there's two things I want to get to here. I mean, the first, the next big plot beat is that the old housekeeper manages to film them basically talking to each other like family members on her phone, I believe it is. And then it leads to this great, it's sort of like the noodle scene that we were talking about before, this great standoff scene where it's almost like your classic, hostage situation or quote unquote Mexican standoff scene in an action movie, except for all of the suspense revolves around her wielding her phone like it's a gun.
And she's ready to text the evidence at any time to blackmail the family.
Right. She says, at least as the subtitles put it, stop right there or I'll push the send button, which is, it's instead of stop right there, I'll shoot. It's just I'm going to send this text message.
You really feel the great cost of what we've come to think of as the poor family when they decide to essentially beat up the bunker couple and lock them inside the bunker, presumably to starve to death.
And before we leave this scene where the I would call it sort of the turning of the movie where the bunker people are discovered, it's worth mentioning that while the rich woman, Mrs. Park, is eating this special noodle dish that she demanded be prepared in 8 minutes before her arrival, she's telling the housekeeper, the mother of the Kim family, the story of her son's traumatization and how he remembers seeing this ghost in the house and how that's turned him into this disturbed little kid that she now thinks he is. And as she tells that story, we see a flashback. And of course, what he was really seeing was a face peering up out of the bunker, the husband of the housekeeper, who nobody knew was down there.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office.
More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
So there's two things that we have to discuss before we get to the climactic birthday scene, which are first, you know, when the Parks come back, we get this scene that I think is kind of a microcosm of the whole movie where the Mr. Kim, who I don't know if we said on here, he's played by Song Kang-ho,
who's one of Bong's big muses, long-time Bong collaborator,
also just like a very famous and accomplished actor in Korea, but specifically with Bong, he's made Memories of Murder and The Host, and he's also in Snowpiercer. He's one of the few Korean characters in that movie, which has like an extremely international cast. I guess it's mostly American and British, but so anyway, the Mr. Kim in this scene that's kind of a microcosm of the movie gets stuck under this table, so he's again kind of like underneath, whereas the Parks are just like lounging on the couch watching their son play, you know, kind of Cowboys and Indians, where he's going to sleep in his teepee in the yard. And like they start having sex and he has to just kind of sit there and listen to it. I think, is it also during this scene where they also start to talk about how they keep saying that like poor people have a particular smell?
Yeah, and that becomes really important later on.
Right.
I mean, that is kind of an emotional crux of the movie, I feel like, because it's a moment when you realize the humiliation that the father, the Song Kang-ho character, feels, you know, every moment of his job. I mean, he's been treated pretty well by the guy that he drives for, and he's managed also to get into this family scam of sort of, I'm this very loyal employee and I'm this top VIP driver, and, you know, he's made up this firm that he supposedly works for. But it's a moment when it really comes down to brass tacks, and the guy he works for is talking about how he smells like basement mildew, basically. And the sting that that causes in him is something that's going to come up later in the big climactic finale.
Right. It's one of many reminders in this movie that, like, there's this idea that basically no matter what these people do and how hard they work, they're never really going to be, you know, climb up the ladder of society. And so the other thing is the flood.
I mean, I have to just admire the filmmaking of the flood. All there really is to say about the flood is, I mean, I was talking about how this is a movie about two interiors, the basement apartment and the gorgeous architect house. But then we suddenly get this exterior scene. It's almost like the movie's two biggest set pieces, you know, the party sequence at the architect's house and this flood sequence come right back to back. And it's just one of those moments where literally Bong is pulling out the stops. You know, he built an entire set. I heard Bong talking about this after the screening I saw, and he apparently built an entire set in a water tank. That whole alley that they live in is just a built set so that he could flood it completely with this sewage water. And it's this combination, again, of kind of like earthy scatological comedy, right? They're kind of swimming in shit, literally, and just high action thriller drama. So the Kim's apartment is completely flooded. The only thing that they managed to salvage that we see is the scholar stone that Ingu was talking about, which seems really important to the boy who's gotten it from his friend. He takes it and hugs it to his chest and removes it from the apartment.
It's very metaphorical.
As everyone in this movie is always pointing out. I can't remember if the stone is one of the things they say that about. But
no, the stone totally is. I mean, part of the joke with the stone, right, is just that it's so completely useless to this poor family who just needs, like, material comfort and Wi-Fi and so on. And then this one person who's managed to gain a few advantages just gives them, like, a big rock that's supposed to have, like, either figurative or supernatural significance, and it's
I mean,
like,
it's more than useless, as we'll get to. I mean, it's
well,
actively
it's
harmful
it's,
to them as the
yes.
movie goes on, but it is one of the things he salvages from the apartment. And anyway, I mean, all there is to say about that flood piece, I think, is just that it's a kind of magnificent piece of filmmaking that also, again, as every scene in this movie seems to do, underlines those same themes of social stratification and the kind of hopelessness of the life that they're living. So right after they've just had this luxurious fantasy that they're going to move into the architect's yeah. house and marry into that family, et cetera, they find themselves just trying to salvage a couple of things from their house in this sea of sewage.
Yeah, and so they kind of reach their low point. And then there's a sort of twist of the knife where, you know, it's like this whole sequence about how shit, like, literally rolls downhill. And then later we get this sequence of the parks talking about it. They just say that rain was a blessing because to them it just, like, cleared up all the pollution. And where they live up on this nice, you know, hill, apparently, in this nice house, like, it was just a cleansing rain. Whereas,
right. It made their nice lives just a little bit nicer. Right. There's also a kind of an incredible scene of the Kims pulling themselves together out of nothing the next morning because they're sleeping in this huge gymnasium where the whole neighborhood has been relocated after the flood. They get a call from the parks the next morning saying, oh, guess what? We've decided to throw a surprise birthday party for our son, and we're going to need all of you, our employees, here in fancy clothes at this particular time of day. And, you know, so the Kims really have to pull it together by just going through the goodwill table at this emergency shelter and kind of trying to make themselves look like the VIP employees that they've been pretending to be.
And by the way, it's Sunday, and also, can you get here in, like, the next 2 hours?
So we get a montage of this party being put together in the yard by the hired labor that is the Kim family. And then we get this great birthday party climax scene where all three of the families, including the subterranean one, are going to converge in this maelstrom of violence.
So when we last saw the bunker couple, essentially, they were so injured that the woman who had been the housekeeper had a concussion, and then she eventually sort of, like, dies very
quickly. She dies off
thereafter.
Screen, right? We never see her die, I think, which is a really sad part of the movie, I think, that her death happens off screen.
And the bunker man had basically been tied to a pipe or something in the basement. He has loosened himself and is basically coming up from the basement, from the bunker, in order to get his revenge. In the 4 years that he's been trapped down there, he has sort of, like, gained this, like, weird loyalty to the wealthy family. And so the only people that he really wants to target is the poor family, and they are sort of, like, in different costumes, essentially, like, partly as, like, the help, and the father, the chauffeur, is dressed as a Native American because there's this, like, long-running theme of the wealthy boy being obsessed with what he would call Indians, and essentially having, like, this, like, weird whim catered to. And then there's, like, a whole scene where the art tutor, the girl from the poor family, is supposed to be attacked by Indians, and the little boy is supposed to, like, come rescue her. And so there's already sort of this, like, staging of pretend violence. And then the guy from the bunker comes out and essentially sort of, like, starts to wreak his vengeance, which is quite haphazard, I think is like a good word for it. Like the son from this poor family ends up sort of unconscious in the kitchen very quickly because of him.
And not just unconscious, but we assume dead, right? I mean, lying in a pool of blood because he's been struck by, metaphorically enough, the scholar's stone that he now is carrying around with him as this kind of talisman.
Yeah. And then he, I think, stabs the girl in the poor family. And like all of this like crazy trauma that's happening, it gives the little boy a seizure. And so the only thing that like the wealthy father wants to do is take his son to the hospital. The father of the poor family is sort of paralyzed because he still wants to keep up the appearance of being like the chauffeur, but he also needs to attend to his bleeding daughter. And so that's sort of like at the point at which the scam like completely comes loose. The mother of the poor family and the bunker guy sort of like end up in a big tussle on the floor. And because the mother had sort of been this, I guess, like professional athlete in her previous life, ends up killing the bunker guy.
Via shish kebab, right? Doesn't she stab him with a shish kebab that's got like a bunch of food and sausage on it and stuff?
I think that's right.
Well, I'm just pointing that out because, once again, that scene is horribly gruesome and sad, but also brings in a lot of comedy and action elements.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's staged in this very like kind of North by Northwest kind of way in which it's this really gruesome, bloody scene. But it's also a birthday party and it's like extremely sunny. Like it's the most brightly lit scene in the movie by far, I feel like. So it has a lot of fun with that.
Right.
Contrast.
It also has the kind of dramatic irony of a Hitchcock scene where for a long time we know what's happening and the partygoers don't. And there's actually a shot where all the partygoers are looking in one direction, right, because it's the lighting of the birthday candles, I think. And only we know that this, you know, underground bunker, long bunker bound crazed killer is coming up behind them with a knife.
Right. Well, and specifically what triggers the seizure from the boy, I think, is that, you know, it's not just that he like sees this guy come up, but for him, it's the ghost who lives in the basement and like, he's trying to have his trauma recovery cake and recover from his ruined birthday party, but instead the like monster from the basement appears, and so he starts losing it. So Mr. Kim is given this terrible choice between, you know, driving his boss and like stopping his daughter from bleeding out. And I think what he does is hand over the car keys, right? And like there's a sense where that there's a sort of false cadence where we think things are starting to resolve. But it's then I believe that Mr. Park, the sort of rich dad, like just can't deal with the smell of these people who have been in sewage all night or whatever. And Mr. Kim picks up on that and finally just like loses it and stabs him, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly the motivation for it. Yep, just that little sniff. And that's one of those examples of, you know, a seed that was planted earlier just paying off in this immensely satisfying and also horrifying way. All right, even just contemplating that scene makes me want to run back and see Parasite again and see how it all stacks up together. But we should get to the coda of the movie, which is, I mean, it's really more than a coda. It's almost like a final act where all these various denouements happen. We jump ahead in time. We don't know exactly how much, but we suddenly also for the first time get a voiceover. There hasn't been any use of voiceover previously in the movie, but suddenly we hear the boy's voice, the Kim's son, Choi Woo-shik, telling us what the unraveling of all of this was in the courts and legally and sort of where how they got to be where they are at the end of the movie. So one of the things that happens is that the entire family's scheme gets unraveled and the mother and son have to spend some time in jail. All we know at that point is what the mother and son know, which is that the father had disappeared immediately after the stabbing incidents at the party and is now the object of this national manhunt that we hear about on TV. The whereabouts of the daughter we learn in this very sad way when we see the mother and son, once their prison term for fraud has been served, going to visit her grave, her kind of mausoleum site. And you realize that she bled to death at the party and that the family is completely torn apart because of that. They're back living in the basement again, completely poor, and they don't know where the father is and have heard nothing from him. So the big dramatic twist of the last part of the movie is for the son to discover where his father is.
And so essentially he sort of like returns he goes to the woods where he can sort of get like a view of the house from quite afar, and he sees this light flickering, and he had sort of known that there was a way in which the Bunker Man, when he had been alive, had been using Morse code in order to communicate with the little boy. Basically, the little boy wasn't really sure what was happening, but the Bunker Man, in his loneliness, was sort of using that Morse code to flick on lights in the house, like from the basement. And so when the son notices that there is also a continuous flickering of light, he figures out that his father is in the bunker. And then we get this like very dreamy scene where throughout the movie, the son had been saying, like, I'm finally going to like buckle down, figure out some way to go to college, and I'm going to get married, and I'm going to do everything the right way, and I'm going to become wealthy beyond imagination, and I'm going to buy that house, and I'm going to reunite with my father, and like my whole family can come together again.
Right. And there's this great fantasy scene of all of them meeting again on the lawn of the house.
Right. Well, and we don't.
Yes.
I think that we're not really supposed to know it's a fantasy, right? Like, there's, it's just being shown to us. And there was a moment in my head where I was briefly like, oh no, this movie better not fuck this up and just like have him in the end grow up to buy this house and free his dad, which is totally how this movie would end in if it was made by pretty much any American studio.
Yeah, which is hard to imagine in the first place, such a movie ever being undertaken.
Sure, although, you know, we had us, right? Like, it's not entirely out of the question, but...
Yeah, but to me that was clear it was a fantasy.
So, like, once you realize that this entire thing has been a fantasy sequence, and it's just, like, one more layer of, like, the son, or sort of like this wealthy family, constantly dreaming that one day they will be rich, you realize that, like, the class difference between them and, like, whoever might live in that mansion is so vast that there's just, like, no way of, like, ever reaching that level of wealth, which means that, like, the son and, like, his mother will never be able to reunite with, like, his father ever again. And so right. That's sort of, like, where you're left with at the end of the movie.
Right. Isn't the final shot just the son back in the depressing sub-basement apartment? Like, yeah. I feel like they show his whole fantasy of upward mobility, and if he just pulls himself up by his bootstraps, he'll save his dad and buy this house, and they'll all live happily ever after. And then there's just, like, a cut back to him alone in his depressing apartment.
Yeah, I think
and then it ends. And it's just such a perfect ending. I mean, and as an American watching it, I think it's natural to, like, it's basically like they're showing what we would think of as the American dream. And then the final reveal is like, nope, that's all it is. Just a dream. It's like an illusion. And then the movie ends.
And I think it's even more than a cut back to the basement apartment. It's a downward tilt, right? I mean, it's one of those moments, again, where every camera movement that Bong uses signifies something. And I think the very last thing you see is similar to the first movement you see the camera do, sort of going down from street level into the semi-basement apartment that he still lives in, where he's, you know, dictating this letter to his father that will never be, as far as we can imagine, yeah, read or heard. So, yeah, I mean, whatever brief moment of respite you got from that fantasy sequence is really undercut by that brutal final shot.
I think there's a lot of ways that, like, analyzing a movie can sort of, like, I don't know, like, depress your enjoyment of it. And I think that, like, with this conversation, the more we sort of pick it apart and identify, like, all of the different elements that contribute toward this, like, magical film, I've really grown to appreciate it even more. I hope that was the same for you guys.
Yeah, it made me want to see it more. I mean, this is one of those movies that the minute it ended, I wanted it to start rolling again so I could just see how the whole thing was put together, because it's very, I mean, to make a joke very much in the movie spirit, it's architectural. You know, it's really built from the ground up in this very elaborate way. And so even our talking through it, even though we've all seen it fairly recently, I mean, it's really hard to remember how all these moving parts fit together. And this conversation made me want to run back to the theater and re-see it to think about it some more.
Yeah, I mean, we keep talking about how every camera movement means something, and that's not a coincidence. Like, Bong has talked about how he's very deliberate in storyboarding out every single camera movement in his movies, like every frame. And I can't wait to see it again. I'm also like, I'm a little bit frustrated that it's hard to see again right now because it's selling out constantly. Even this past weekend, the 9:30 a.m. showings in New York were sold out. But it's also really fun that this movie that is as accessible as it is a movie that's in Korean with subtitles and has no major movie stars, and yet it's still doing quite well so far, and I hope it continues to do well, and I hope it wins all of the awards.
Extremely gratifying, yeah, that it had as big an opening as it did as a opener just in the big coastal cities, and now as it starts to open wider across the country in the fall, I think it's going to be one of those movies that has a really long tail and that people are still talking about for the rest of the year, and that hopefully will get some awards recognition. Although, as you say, with a subtitled movie from Korea, it's not necessarily that obvious that it will.
Oh, right. Although I think the hope is that it'll succeed on the Roma model, right? Like Roma was a subtitled movie with no major movie stars, and yet it managed to get itself a Best Picture nomination and to be a real contender. And so I hope that's what happens with this movie. And I think we've shown it certainly, like, it holds up to the scrutiny of being discussed for hours or months.
Yeah,
or
it's one of those movies that's satisfyingly smarter than you are, you know, that when you think it you have it figured out, it always stays a step ahead and does something unexpected. Okay, our love fest is coming to an end. Thank you, Forrest and Ingu, for coming in to spoil Parasite.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Our engineer today was Merritt Jacob. Our producer is Rosemary Belson. If you have ideas for future shows or movies you would like us to spoil, you can always write us at spoilers@slate.com. And for Forrest Wickman and Ingu Kang, this is Dana Stevens. We'll talk to you soon.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.